So good morning, everybody. Some of you have been up for an hour or two. Some of you maybe been up for three or four. I've probably been up longer than you because I had to prepare my talk. Or I could have just shown up, but I decided to be responsible. And you might ask yourself, or I might ask you, have you had a good experience so far this morning? Have you had a good experience? How's your experience been? How was it getting up? How was it looking out and seeing the darkness? How was it getting yourself ready and coming over here? How was it? The Zen truism is what? That everything depends on our mind. That everything depends on our mind and our thinking. If you look at me closely, you'll see I have a tan. This means I've been in a Shangri-La. It sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But everything depends on the mind. Before I left for my Shangri-La, I saw the movie Descendants. How many of you have seen the movie Descendants? Well, not three of you. Well, one of the sub-themes of the movie Descendants is really that everything depends on the mind. Because the Descendants takes place in Kauai, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world. I think the most beautiful of the Hawaiian Islands, and I've been all over. And the whole movie is set against just amazing, spectacular backdrop of sea, of mountains, background Hawaiian music, and then everybody in their flowered shirts and relaxed atmosphere. But everything depends on the mind. Everything depends on the mind. So, same stuff is going on, same issues, same conflicts, same worries and concerns and feeling one-upped by... it's the Descendants, so it's about it. I won't get into it. It's about this very wealthy extended family in Hawaii and how they deal with their issues and their conflicts in the Shangri-La. So Shakespeare told us this, right? There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That's what Shakespeare told us, right? Our last retreat in beginning of December, I talked about the myth of Sisyphus. So Sisyphus is the god who is doomed to the underworld, where he has to push a rock up to the top of the hill, and then what happens when he gets to the top of the hill? And he follows it down. That's his doom. And Albert Camus really got into that. And so he titled one of his books Sisyphus or something about Sisyphus. Pardon?
Never mind. I was going to say The Myth of Sisyphus.
Oh, is that what he titled the book? Okay. And despair. Lack of hope. You can't accomplish anything. The rock's going to fall down. What's worth anything if you just get up and it goes down? So for Camus, for Sartre, for Kierkegaard, this is the human condition. We have to struggle perpetually and without hope of success. Oh, we get a little bit of success for a second. We get up to the top, but it goes down very fast. Okay, so that's one take. That's one take on it. That's one thing the mind does with it. But that's not exactly what we do with it in Zen. So I'll tell you a story that I've told before about Shinryu Suzuki Roshi. So Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, my first teacher, he liked to work with stones. And he liked to build stone walls. And we were down at Tassajara, the Zen monastery in California, and he was always wanting to build stone. Well, there was one wall he was trying to build in particular. And he was a small man, so we'd have a lot of big guys helping him. I was not a big guy, so I had to empty the garbage while the big guys were helping him. I was on garbage duty. It's true. But this was at this was in a deep valley in California where there are torrential rains, torrential downpours in the winter, not in the summer, but in the winter and the spring. So he would do his work, and we would go back to San Francisco and come back to most of it would be gone. He'd get out there in his robes, and his wife would say, no, change. She didn't want him working in his robes. And he'd be out there doing it, and day after day, it was what he loved to do. He didn't like to prepare for talks. He liked to work with stones. That's what he liked to do. That was his preparation for talks, working with stones. And, they were sometimes beautiful, and then there'd be huge setbacks. And then one day, when I was emptying the garbage or something, he was up at the top of this wall that they were creating, but it was on an embankment, and he slipped, and he fell down, and he rolled all the way down. Now, you know, as I get older, it gets longer and longer. It seems to me now that it must have been a 30 feet, although it may have just been 6 feet. Do you know about memory? It's kind of cool memory, isn't it? Kind of cool. So I remember seeing him roll over and over and thinking, oh, he's old. You know, he was old. He was in his 60s, over 60. And I thought, he's old. And he got down to the bottom of the hill at least 30 feet, maybe 40 feet, 50 feet. And he picked himself up, and he wiped himself off, dusted himself off, and he said, just like a stone. And then he went back up to the top. So here we have a different attitude. A little different attitude than Sisyphus's, than Camus. Same stones, right? Same stones. Everything depends on the mind. Everything depends on the mind, on our thinking. On our thinking. So Zen practice is really about resiliency training. That's what it's about. Resiliency training. Adjusting the mind to what is. So a story that Alan Watts told many, many years ago, it must be in one of his books, is when he went to Japan and he took Americans with him to Japan. He took Americans with him to Japan, and the Americans had heard all of his talks on Zen that he gave, and you know, he was a really a very charismatic talker. He's one of the early Zen people who brought Zen to the West. He's actually an Anglican minister who gave up the Anglican way and got into Zen. Well, I won't get into all that stuff. Anyway, he took these guys to Japan to a Zen monastery, and they were following the teacher around. The teacher was showing them stuff, and the teacher kept bowing to all of the, as we do in traditional Zen. I noticed we weren't doing much of it this morning, but traditional Zen, he was bowing to everything, bowing to all the statues, bowing when he left, and the American was just following him around, and he said to the guy finally, he said, well, I thought this was Zen. He said, I thought this was about liberation from dependence on the outside world. And here you are, bowing to all of these statues. All these statues, and the teacher supposedly said, and then the American said, I could just as easily spit on them, and the Japanese teacher said, okay, I bows your spits, I bows your spits, why not? So resiliency training, which really is what Zen is, isn't something that actually someone can teach you. I don't think Suzuki Roshi taught it to me. I don't think I can teach it to you guys. He role modeled, I think, in just the way he was. Possibly I'm role modeling for you. I don't know. I don't know. And he encouraged us to practice meditation, do a regular meditation practice and retreats and over again, so that we could begin to see the patterns of thinking that constrain us, that we get obsessed by, that limit our world, so that we could begin to see those and begin to disidentify with them. If we see them, that's the beginning of disidentification. Just seeing, not commenting on it. Commenting on it is a new one. But just seeing is the beginning of disidentification. And in the retreat that I was talking about how each thought is like a bubble, and a pattern of thinking is like a pattern of bubbles. And in our meditation, we can see these patterns of bubbles rise up, and we can actually see that a bubble only lasts how long? How long does it last? But these patterns of bubbles are obsessive. We obsess about them. And we don't realize that they're just this long, and then they're gone. Just this long, and then they're gone. So Suzuki Roshi coined the term big mind, which actually comes out of the literature, but he coined the vernacular term, big mind, to be the mind that can just be present and see those patterns of thinking, those bubbles as they come up, and disidentify with them, which doesn't require any effort other than just being present. That's the effort. So Suzuki and Camus were born within 10 years of each other. They both had horrible experiences in World War II. One in Japan, the other in France, in Algeria. Camus is actually from Algeria. They had awful, awful experiences. Camus' way of being in the world, Sartre's way of being in the world, Kierkegaard's way of being in the world, and that whole movement in Europe came out of the horror of World War II. But Suzuki went through the same thing. He went through exactly the same thing. Japan, then getting out of Japan at some point and coming back to Japan. But he had the practice. He had been doing that practice, that meditation practice, since he was a young man, since he was a boy. He was able to manifest resiliency. And I don't mean to imply that resiliency means that we won't suffer, that we finally complete resiliency training. Oh, I'm a teacher around here. I'm just resilient. You know, I just go with the flow. Ooh. It's not completed training. That's a pattern in our mind, complete and incomplete, right? That's a pattern in our mind. How can it be complete? Something made up. William Wadsworth, I quoted him in the retreat. This is right. Suffering is permanent, obscure and dark, and shares the nature of infinity. It's true. But we can have a resilient attitude toward that suffering. We can have a resilient attitude and be A-okay in the middle of it. Be A-okay. Because they're just bubbles. They're just bubbles. So I also talked during a retreat about my friends, and I'm fictionalizing their names, Bud and Mary Kay. Oops. I didn't entirely fictionalize. Well, I meant... <Oops. laughs> Wait. Okay. Bud and Mary Kay. So I've known them for years. But you will never know them. I'm trying to protect boundaries, you know. You will never know them. They will never sit fat foot in this sandal. Bud and Mary Kay. So a couple who have been together, friends of mine, have been together for more than 50 years. That's a pretty long time, right? And had a wonderful complementary relationship. And Mary Kay, not Bud, has been the Buddhist practitioner, the meditation practitioner. And they raised a whole bunch of children. They had three or four regular children, and then three or four adopted children. They're regular too, but you know, they added to the family. And they had a wonderful complementary relationship in terms of their work and their child care and everything. They always have. And but then last year, all of a sudden, Bud was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, just like that. One week he's running the marathon, and the next week he's got early Alzheimer's, right? So Mary Kay has to quit her job. She has to all of a sudden deal with her husband in a different way. Her husband, who's been her peer, who's been the father of her children, who's been her colleague, she has to start parenting her husband. Parenting her husband, and he doesn't want to be parented. And he has to. The doctor says he shouldn't have a driver's license anymore. So Mary Kay has to tell him. And so, here's a chance, an opportunity. It's heartbreaking, but it's an opportunity to do resiliency, to just be with him in a new way, to develop some new patterns of thinking, and to help him develop new patterns of thinking to the degree he's able to. That's life. But through our meditation practice, we have this ability. Unfortunately, the suffering comes unanticipated and just hits us, like with Mary Kay. It just hit her. Well, that's just the way life is. Just when Suzuki was when World War II came along, he didn't want World War II. He was totally against it. He thought, well, the Soto Zen people are not going to go for it. But they totally went for it. And this was something that was very upsetting to him. But what could he do? He could be alive. He could be available. He could do his best to deal with his own heartache and the heartache around him without identifying with some rigid pattern of thinking. Any pattern of thinking we identify as rigid. Any. But we need patterns of thinking. Mary Kay has to develop new patterns of thinking now. Parenting patterns. She thought she was done with parenting. 25 years ago, she's got to pull some of those new patterns of thinking back. But she has to use them very differently than she did with her 8-year-old, right? Because she's using them with her 68-year-old. So it has. But this is life. This is life. So we have a choice between developing the quiet resiliency of just being with what is, or becoming a dour Camus or Sisyphus or Timothus or whatever. We have that choice. And if we continue our practice, we'll see what Wei Ning, the sixth ancestor, meant when he said, "Our pure mind is in the depraved one. Our pure mind is in the depraved one." Now, it's a little easier to see how the depraved mind is in the pure one, I think. A big mind. So Suzuki Roshi talked big mind. Well, a small mind would be in big mind, right? It would be all of our worries and concerns would be in big mind. But the other way around, the big mind is in small mind, that our pure mind is in the depraved one. But that's pretty simple too, isn't it? Because all the depraved mind is a series of bubbles that we obsessively identify with. Any series of bubbles, series of thoughts that we obsessively identify with is the depraved mind, or that we compulsively act out. Maybe we don't even know. Maybe unconsciously we're identifying with it, and unconsciously we're acting it out. That's the depraved mind. But what's inside those bubbles? Space, light, color. Big mind. Inside each of those bubbles. And of course, as I said, I can't teach you this. My teacher couldn't teach me this. And yet, I was always listening to him talk, as you guys are always listening to me talk. Always studying sutras, always. So if this can't be taught, what are we doing? What are we doing? We have these study groups, and we. During retreat, I talk every day for an hour or more. What's going on here? What's going on? Well, we're doing this to get help, to get support. Not from the patterns of thinking, but from the feeling behind the thoughts. The feeling, the calm, the joy, the quiescence behind the teaching. Behind the teaching. The flavor and scent of it. The sense of life that's conveyed by big mind, which is not different from small mind. So Suzuki was, and you've heard me say this before, more so than Katagiri, he was inarticulate when I worked with him. Is that right? Well, I don't know. Whatever you say, work with him. He was inarticulate. And if you see Zen mind, beginner's mind, you think, oh, do you know how many hours of editing went into that? Trudy Dixon died of cancer. Well, she would have almost died of something else based on the hours and hours of editing she did. He did say all those things. But... but the feeling behind it, the feeling of openness, the feeling of a quiet joy that just pervades everything. It's not based on thought pattern, but includes thought pattern. Why would you kick thought pattern out? You need thought pattern. You need encouragement. So I've talked a few times here about the... Well, I've talked a lot of times here about dreams I've had, but I've talked a few times lately about one particular dream, and I haven't had it since I've talked about it anymore. It makes me feel kind of sad, but that's resiliency, I guess. So this is a dream that I have about every, and many of you have heard it already a couple times, every 6 to 18 months or every 5 to 19 months or something, I don't know. And I've been having it for about 10 years. And in the dream, so my teacher Suzuki Roshi actually died in 1972. You know, so that makes me pretty old, right? 1972. So in that dream, he's alive. You know, he's doing stuff. He's giving a teaching. And then the dream ends, and just before the dream ends, I say to him, what do I say? This, you remember. I say, I thought you were dead. And what does he do? He laughs. He chortles. He chortles. And then I wake up. And I wake up. I've had that dream, you know. I don't know. I lost track of how many times I had that dream. And I only had it since I became the guiding teacher here. Oh, deep. So, and you know, when I wake up, I feel good, right? But I can't remember a thing he said. I can't remember anything that's happened. I don't know. I feel good, and I twice I felt so good that as I was waking up, I thought, "Wow, I want to be a Zen teacher." Then I realized, "Oh, I already am a Zen teacher." That happened twice, just in the last 3 years. So the words start to encourage us. They're to encourage us. But the words themselves are not it. They are it, but it's just, they're not really it. Because they're bubbles. They're beautiful bubbles. They're wonderful bubbles. So here's a poem by Zen teacher Taigi. Not a single stone to throw at the dog, the wintry moon. Not a single stone to throw at the dog, the wintry moon. Your choice. Your choice. We always have the choice between dwelling on small mind and feeling something much more spacious, right in the middle of small mind, right in the middle of it. And I think as human beings, we have a universal desire to go beyond our small-minded patterns of bubbles. I think we do. All of us do. Human beings do. So I was just with my grandsons, who are 6 and 2. And unfortunately, my 2-year-old is taking up a family pattern, which I don't know if it's genetically based or what, and that's tantrums. I mean, you know, kids start having tantrums very, very young. Very young. It's got to be genetically based. And he's not the first one in the family to have tantrums, I'll tell you that. But I'm not going to give you the whole story. Especially because it involves me. So he has tantrums. And then after he has a tantrum, he... whatever big person is around after he's come out of it, he says, "Ugh, ugh, ugh." He wants a hug. "Ugh, Grandpa, ugh, ugh." I give him a hug. I give him a hug. He wants to go beyond his small-minded pattern, and get a hug. We all want uggs, don't we? We all want to go beyond our small-minded patterns and get a little few uggs, don't we? We need as many uggs as we can get. 2-year-old, 20-year-old, 83-year-old, we need uggs. That's Sangha, that's community of friends, supporting each other in this world of suffering, in this world which is not easy for any of us, And my 6-year-old grandson, he also has a universal desire to go beyond his small-minded patterns, his small bubbles. He doesn't have tantrums. He just likes to do revved-up things that will, like we have a big chair in our back porch, and he wants me to sit in it and rotate it. It's on a rotation thing until we're both just totally dizzy. Faster, Grandpa, faster, faster. Everybody wants to change consciousness. It's a human need to change consciousness because our small minds are constrained. And then I get my 6-year-old and my 2-year-old on the swing. And the 3 of us are also dizzy that we can't do anything. But it's delightful. We've changed consciousness. We've altered consciousness. We're not in our small-minded world anymore. And, of course, that is what Zen practice happens. That's what happens in Zen practice. Consciousness does change. But it doesn't change as quickly as we'd like it to, as permanently as we'd like it to, as deeply as we'd like it to, and it sure doesn't change as quick as drugs or alcohol or sex or food. It doesn't. Addiction to drugs, alcohol, sex, and food, I think goes back to the beginning of human consciousness. A lot of people say, oh, we're in a phase of total drug dependency in this country. I go back and read literature from Europe in the 13th century. I don't think so. It's always been like that. Read the Taoists talking about all the drunk fools that they hang out with. It's always been like that. We all, as human beings, want to get out of small mind. We want to have some relief from small mind, from the patterns of bubbles that we get stuck on. And so the easy way is the things that are addicting. Luckily, meditation is not addicting. No, maybe. But the way we do it, it's not very addicting. Because we don't do it in a chaise lounge. We don't do it with some beautiful recorded music, even shakuhachi music. We just do it with the music of our own bubbles. So it's hard to get addicted to that. Probably possible. You may have known people who did, but... So not an easy practice, but actually a practice in which you do and will develop resiliency. I promise you. I promise you. You will be able, if you have not already, to alter your consciousness enough so you disidentify with the different patterns. And this doesn't mean that we don't work with the patterns, too. We still work with the patterns. Listening to all these teachings and trying to make these teachings work in your life, these teachings about resiliency, those are new patterns. Making a commitment to sit. That's it. You have to have a thinking pattern to make that commitment, to stay with that commitment. So those patterns are important. Consciously introducing new patterns to help us disidentify, to help us open up, to help us have a little joy in our lives, regardless of where we are, a little composure, a little love, regardless of what happens, even in the middle of World War II, World War III, or Afghanistan, or wherever, because everything depends on the mind. And if there is real stillness, where else can it be but here? Where else could it be but here? So during retreat, I was talking about one of the ways in which we encourage patterns of thinking is by using names in Buddhism, by giving people names, Buddhist names. And of course, in Christianity, that's done too. So my name is Timothy. I talked about this during retreat. My name is Timothy, named after my Irish grandfather and great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather. Hey, what a deal. And they're all Catholics, right? But I was raised Unitarian. My grandmother, who was the one who was responsible for giving me the name and was a Catholic until the day she died, said to me once when I was something about 9 years old or maybe 10 years old, she said to me, do you know the meaning of your name, dear? And I said, yeah, Timothy. She said, no, do you know the meaning, dear? And I said, what do you mean, Grandma? And she said, oh, it's Timotheos. Timotheos. She said, I talked to your mother about giving you this name. It means to honor God. Honor God. Well, I grew up as a Unitarian. I thought, honor God. I said, Grandma, Daddy doesn't believe in God. He's an atheist. And Mommy says she doesn't know. So what's all this about? I didn't say, that's all I said to her. But she said, she didn't even miss a heartbeat, my grandmother. She usually didn't miss a heartbeat. Didn't miss a, or whatever, a beat. She didn't miss it. She said, oh, that's all right, dear. Just honor what's in front of you. That's good enough. That's good enough. So that was very helpful for me at 9 years old. That was a helpful new pattern of thinking. And actually, I loved my grandmother. She was there for me in many ways. And I kept, when I would be having issues, I would just think, oh, I'm Timothy. I can honor what's in front of me. As difficult as it is, I can honor it. So that's helped me my whole life, that pattern. That Christian pattern. Christian, Buddhist, who cares? Who cares? We need new patterns of bubbles, but we shouldn't get obsessed by any of them. So what's the next one I want to talk about? The next one I talk about is Katagiri's name. Dainin, great patience. And you know, when I first met Katagiri Roshi, he's the head teacher here, he's the founder of the Zen Center. Founder of the Zen Center. When I first met him in San Francisco many, many, many years ago, he did not have great patience. But the last few years before he died, he had incredible patience. Incredible patience, much more than Suzuki, my other teacher, was not named great patience. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. The words we use, what we say to ourselves, what other people say to us, has a huge influence on us. Even though they're just bubbles, they have a huge influence. So let's work with them. Let's respect them. Let's honor them. But let's not get obsessed by them. And Suzuki's name was Shinryu. That was his first name. And someone asked me during retreat, I don't remember who it was, if I knew what Shinryu meant, because I'd been talking about it. And I said, no, I don't know. But then I went and looked it up. You know how I looked it up, right? What? Yes, right. Well, it means, it has a couple of meanings, but it means spring dragon. And Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, in contrast to Katagiri Roshi, was more of a dragon. He had a temper. He would breathe fire. Psh, psh, and then it would be gone. He was not great patience. So, interesting, isn't it? And Suzuki Roshi's name also was, his nickname was, what? What was his nickname? Crooked Cucumber. His teacher called him Crooked Cucumber. And we didn't know it. That's the name that we knew him by. So I'm going to tell you another story. I haven't told this story before. I'll tell you another story. You know, as I get old, all I do is remember these stories from years ago. So please indulge me. So, this story, I'm applying to be a conscientious objector. It's not World War II, it's my Vietnam War. See how old I am? It's Vietnam War. I'm applying to be a conscientious objector. And I go to Suzuki and I say, will he help me? Because he's my minister, right? Even though he's a Zen teacher, I got to have somebody write something. So he says, yeah, he'll write something. And I need to give him my birth certificate. I don't know why. I don't remember this part of it. And actually, he has me write. I'll tell you this part. I don't have enough time to keep talking. Yeah. So he says, so he's going to write something. I come back to him a couple of weeks later. He hasn't written a thing. And I say, but you know, my number's coming up. You know, I'm going to be drafted. Come on, you know, not time. And he said, oh, okay, you write it. He says, you write it. I write it. So I write it. And then I give it to him. And he said, I'll copy it. You write it. I'll copy it. So I write it. I give it to him. And then a couple days later, he brings it down to me. It's copied. In hand written, you know, whatever I wrote. I don't remember what I wrote. And he said, made one change. I said, what was? He said, I put in strict. So he is a strict strict follower of the Buddha and strict meditation practitioner. Oh, okay, that's cool. I'll be strict. Well, strict is necessary to get out of going to Vietnam, right? Who wouldn't be? So then, and then I say, and now I need my birth certificate back. He said, oh, birth certificate? I say, yes, birth certificate. And he goes up, he lives upstairs on the, it's like, the meditation hall is here, and I hear him rumbling up there, upstairs. He comes down, and he says, no. He says, I can't find it. I can't find it. And it's mixed up with Philip's stuff. I can't find it. I went through Philip's stuff, too. Can't find it. Well, I'm not so happy. It's my only birth certificate. Of course, you get none. I'm not happy. And he apologizes. Then the next morning, Sunday morning, he gives his crooked cucumber talk. First time I've heard about that he has that name. And he says, well, you may think that a Zen teacher is really good in lots of ways. But a Zen teacher may not be good in lots of ways. He's good in some ways, not so good in some ways. He said, my teacher called me Crooked Cucumber because I forget things a lot. And I make it very hard for people. And I'm very sad about that. And I try, but I've been trying for 43 years. And I don't know. I'm just Crooked Cucumber. That's what I remember. That's what I remember. And then I remember after that that some of his senior students brought crooked cucumbers and put them on the something or other. And the kitchen was right next to the Zenda. Put a bunch of them in the kitchen. And then he would laugh and point to them. Oh, there I am, he said. So there we are. In that case, the name freed him up and freed the people up around him to accept his fallibility, to accept his, in a humble but open way, his fact that he wasn't perfect. This idea that we can never be perfect is just bubble stuff, isn't it? Just bubble stuff. So, there's nothing good or bad. There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And we just be here together, just working and playing and practicing together. And see what happens. Sometimes we'll be crooked cucumbers, sometimes we'll be straight cucumbers. Sometimes our patterns of behavior will, our patterns of thinking will become obsessive. Sometimes we can just let go. That's just the way it goes. Questions? Comments?
I'm going to misquote him.
Okay.
I think he wrote something like, in the midst of winter, I discovered within myself an endless, inexhaustible summer.
Hey, well, that's Camus. That's not the Camus I know. I mean, great to hear he had that side to him. Great to hear he had that side to him. Uh-huh. Hey, good. Thank you. Thank you. Of course, we always have that side to us. We all have that side to us. We all have that side. Because that moon is always shining. But the dog's always barking. The dog's always growling. What else, you guys? Thank you.